The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay, well done, Pete. We are on time. And I wonder, ladies and gentlemen, are you busy? It's often the way that we, you meet someone or you say hello, you know, how are you? And the answer is, I'm busy. And I wonder if you ever feel time poor. As far as I can track down on the internet, the time poor idea began in the UK around the turn of the century, the idea of being money rich but time poor, which is a very strange expression, isn't it? Because you've got 168 hours a week, you cannot have more than that, and you've got the same amount of time as Bill Gates or Rupert Murdoch or you. How are we time poor? Now, I wonder whether the busyness epidemic, we're busy trying to fit more and more and more into life. There's a man called Tom Crider. Tim Crider wrote an article in the New York Times, and he's very critical of our addiction to my addiction to busyness. Listen to what he says, and I'm not sure if I agree with him, but it's quite a challenging thing. Our frantic days are really just a hedge against emptiness. Busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness. Obviously, your life cannot possibly be silly or trivial or meaningless if you are so busy, completely booked, in demand, every hour of the day. I can't help but wonder whether all this histrionic exhaustion isn't a way of covering up the fact that for most of us, what we do doesn't matter. Well, how do we understand time? How do we understand busyness? How do we understand the way that life should work as we look for the meaning and purpose that we all want so much? That's what the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament part of the Bible addresses. And today we look at the idea of time. Now, inside your program, printed out on the A4 sheet, is some quotes from Ecclesiastes. And the entire little book is actually printed out in the booklet with the houses on the front. If you'd like a copy, please take one. Let me put the book in context for you by reading those verses printed, which are the first verses of this little book. When I say little, it's only 10 pages in my part of the Old Testament. Here we go. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. As far as I know, Ecclesiastes is written either by King Solomon or through the eyes of Solomon. He was a great king in ancient Israel about 950 BC and the patron of the wisdom literature. Here's how he sees the world. Meaningless, meaningless as a teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. The word translated there, meaningless, in the older translations of the Bible, I went for the word vanity. It's hard to translate it into English. The Hebrew word hebel means a mist or a vapor, something that's ephemeral. It's like a mist or on a cold morning, you breathe out and you see your breath and then it's gone. It's that feeling that it's not substantial. It doesn't last. And he's saying life feels like that. It feels like nothing lasts. Nothing's really substantial. The whole world, everything is ephemeral. It's a sandcastle with the tide coming in. And so he asked a question in verse 3, what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? The word gain is a commercial term. It's the idea of what's the bottom line? What's the cash value? You work hard, what do you have to show for it? And the word labour there can cover physical labour or, you know, the mental work. Whether you work with a shovel or a trackpad on a computer, it's the idea of you work hard, what's there to show for it? And the little phrase, under the sun, is very important. As far as I can work out, what he means is this. If you just look out at the world, what do we see? With eyes open and common sense, what's the world look like? He's not an atheist. He knows God is there. But if God had not spoken to us, if God is inscrutable, God is there, but how do we make sense of the world? What is it that you see under the sun? Or sometimes you'll say under the heavens. 29 times in a short little book he mentions it. And so the hard questions he asks, if God hadn't spoken to us, if all we have is what we see, how do we make sense of the world? And this book's written up to almost 3,000 years ago. and yet it reads as if, well, you see how it goes to making sense of the world. So he sets out, at the end of chapter 1, he sets out on a quest to find what it is that really lasts. What is it that we can invest our life in? What will hold the weight that we put on it to give us meaning and purpose? 2 weeks ago, he looked at the idea, in chapter 2, we looked at the idea of wisdom and also hedonism and found that, yeah, while it's fun, it doesn't last. Last week, we looked at the idea of money and possessions, and while they kind of deliver, they don't ultimately hold the weight of the meaning of life. And today, the idea of the question of time in chapter 3. Now, if you look at chapter 3, the very famous poem there actually turned into a folk song by the group The Birds, I think, in the 1960s. You look down, you see verse 2, he talks about the biggest events in life, a time to be born and a time to die. Verse 3, creative and destructive things uproot and plant to kill and to heal. Verse 4, about emotions, public and private, joy and sorrow. Verses 5 and 6, about building and possessions. Verse 7, about speaking or silence. Verse 8, personal relations, love and hate, national relations, peace and war. But the way to actually understand a poem is to read it and get the vibe. So let me read it now, and you'll get it. You'll get the vibe as I read it. You'll understand what it is that the author's saying. Here we go. Chapter 3, verse 1. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. You get it, don't you? It's the pendulum, or perhaps the metronome, backwards and forwards as the seasons come and go and come and go. And what he's saying is this: life is not an endless stream of just undifferentiated minutes counted off on a digital watch or a sundial. Life is a series of seasons and times that come and go. And he's got 14 pairs there, and they list, you know, from the biggest, our birth and our death, to smaller things like to sow and to mend, personal things like love and hate, national things like war and peace. And here's the implication, as far as I can see. Wisdom lies not in a particular action, like buy or sell or speak or be quiet. Wisdom lies in understanding the time or the season. Is it time to buy or is it time to sell? Now, on the stock market, anybody can buy and sell any time. Real wisdom is, what's the season to buy or to sell? What's happening in the Sydney retail real estate market? Is it time to buy or is it time to sell? That's the question. Or is it time to speak up or is it time to shut up? It's all, if you want your words to really count, it's all about timing. Now, I can usually think of what to say about 24 hours later, after the event. There's a proverb in the Old Testament that says, a person finds joy in giving an apt reply, and how good is a timely word. Like I say, for me, it's usually 24 hours later, I think, oh, I should have said. I've got one mate who's very good at it. He's an Anglican minister. He started work as a chaplain with one of the professional rugby league clubs in Sydney. I won't say which club. But there was one of the players there, high profile, bit of a media personality, a bit of a smarty pants, that's the word I'd say, smarty pants, you know what I mean. Anyway, this player's in the dressing room and my friend the chaplain walks in, it's fairly new. The player looks at the chaplain and says, ah, so you're the new chaplain, are you? Ha ha, yes, I am. What can you do for me as chaplain? I looked him straight in the eye and said, I do a good funeral. Well, why can't I think of things like that to say? So wisdom lies in this. There's a time to work and there's a time to rest. There's a time to study and there's a time to kick back. If you mix up those times, life will get messy. Either you'll lose your job because you're lazy or you'll collapse with exhaustion because you've never rested. You see, it's understanding those times. And there's also bigger seasons in life. When you're a teenager, you're allowed to do dumb things, right? You act like a buffhead when you're a teenager. Ah, he or she's just a teenager. If I act like a teenager at age 60, it's going to be pretty awkward, yeah? My job now is to be a granddad and a 60-year-old. Or the pendulum of life swings from when we begin life totally dependent on our parents. And for many of us, the pendulum will swing where our parents are totally dependent on us. My wife Kathy's been the primary carer for her mum and dad for the last 4 or 5 years as they've got very elderly. And I remember one day after she'd taken them out for lunch at a shopping mall, she came back and said, "Well, life goes full circle. There comes a time when you carry wet wipes for your parents." I can hardly wait. Now, you see, verse 11 is talking about God making, well, I'll read verse 11. He's made everything beautiful in its time. That is, wisdom is the right event at the right time is beautiful. And that can be for something as small as that first coffee in the morning. How good is that? Or the leaves changing as autumn comes. Or in 3 months' time, we'll get that first sniff of spring as the weather begins to change. Or in family life, it might be, you know, the first day at school, and then one day you'll see the last day at school. Or it might be closing the deal at work after a whole lot of time, or winning the case, whatever it is, or the first day of holidays. The right event at the right time, or the right action at the right time, is beautiful. And we try hard to control our lives too. It's got something to say about that. We work so hard to control our lives. I find myself always busy. So when I used to use a paper diary, I thought if I just buy a bigger diary, it might help. So I bought a huge A4 diary, but I didn't seem to find any extra time. Now I've got a computerized diary. I checked. I go right up to 100 years' time. There, 2119. I checked on a Thursday morning. I'm still coming to City Bible Forum legal. There you go. I'll be there. It doesn't seem to help, really. I read Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He's very good, smart and good-looking, I think. But I read that and I realised why my life is chaotic. I haven't been able to fix it, but I realised why. And then I bought his sequel, First Things First, about getting your life together. I bought it, but I didn't get to read it because I lost it on an aeroplane, left it in the thing in front of the seat, and then walked off. And I couldn't bring myself to ring the airline and say, the book that I bought to get my life in order and my act together, I've lost it before I read it. And so I just didn't ever get to finish. Anyway, that's... We schedule the happy times in life. I've got 4 weddings in the year planner this year. One is my daughter, niece, a nephew, friend, etc. We schedule the happy times. But you know what? We never schedule the times to mourn, and yet they will come, inevitably. Stephen Covey, the management guru, clever, clever man, the great planner, dies in a bicycle accident in Utah. Sad. And I guarantee it wasn't in his year planner. One other thing to look, so we don't control the seasons that come and go. Another thing, if you look at them, they cancel each other out. We tear and we mend, we laugh and we weep, we build and we tear down, we're born and we die, and nothing's accomplished. Nothing changes. And so you see verse 9, Solomon asks, chapter 3, verse 9, asks the same question as he asked way back at the beginning of the book, in 1 verse 3. He says this, "What do workers gain from all their toil? You work so hard, and what is ultimately accomplished?" Because he can see, he lists in this chapter 4 problems under the sun. Remember I'm saying, under the sun, as if God had not spoken to us, if we didn't know more than this. I'll give you those 4 problems very quickly, but I'm sure you'll pick it up. You'll be able to read it again later on too. First problem is this, verse 10. He says, "I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end." Now, what's the burden? We live with eternity in our hearts. That's simply what the Hebrew word means. This awareness that there's more somehow, and yet... And people can see it. Whether or not... At either end of the intellectual food chain, people have seen it. So, for example, Fred Hoyle, a British mathematician and astronomer last century, brilliant man, public atheist, said this as he looked at the way the fine-tuning of various forces in the universe. He said this, "A common-sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super-intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion beyond question." You can see it is as if so many things are totally fine-tuned to make life possible. Well, if you really, really don't want to see that, let's come up with a multiverse theory that there's an infinite number of universes and... anyway, and I'll just leave that. Or at the other end of the intellectual food chain, Arthur Stace heard the message of eternity, understood, and last century wrote, they estimate about 500,000 times wrote eternity in chalk on the sidewalks of Sydney. In fact, does anyone remember what went on the Harbour Bridge and the millennial celebrations? I thought it was kind of an irony that Sydney would choose eternity as a way of celebrating, but it's there, it's in our hearts. Did you see the end of verse 11? "Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Left on our own, we have this feeling we cannot work it out. If you can't work it out, there's a kind of an answer in verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and do good while they live, that each one of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God." Try and enjoy yourself. It's meaningless, it won't last, but enjoy yourself, and if you can, well, that's a gift of God. I'm going to run out of time, so the second problem is in verses 14 and 15, where he says, look, it seems that God has made the world, God's ultimately in control, and verses 14 and 15, I think, are saying, it goes in circles and you cannot change it. I'm going to go to the third problem in verse 16. He says, "And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there." Now, I think it's fair to say that there's been a loss of trust and respect for many institutions in our society in the last generation. Government, banks, media, and the church as well. There's an organisation, Transparency International, rates various countries on levels of corruption. They define corruption as the abuse of entrusted power for private gain. They rank 180 countries, number one being the best or least corruption, number 180, the most corruption in the society. Denmark is number one, New Zealand is number two, Australia ranks at number 13. You can actually go to the website and the colours show. The darker the red, the more the corruption. The lighter the yellow, the less the corruption. We're number 13 and people worry about corruption or misuse of power here. I cannot imagine what it's like to live in countries down in the 170s, etc. Just, anyway, as I say, Ecclesiastes 3,000 years old, absolutely still relevant. Verse 17, I think, is the idea of an intuitive thing, right? God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. It's like every dog has their day. It will come back to bite them, I think, is what he's saying. But it's the fourth problem that really pushes, the fourth problem that flattens everything else. See verse 18. Remember, under the sun, this is saying, just what we see. He says, verse 18, "I also said to myself, as for humans, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless." Notice he's saying nothing lasts is the point. That's the Hebel word. "All go to the same place. All come from dust and to dust all return. Who knows if the human spirit rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth." I don't know if you can see the screen. This is Musket. He's a beloved member of our family, Staffordshire Terrier. On the left is him wrestling with my son. On the right, him just relaxing. He's 13 years old, which is getting old for a Staffy. And so most of the time now, he just lies around. He's got arthritis in his shoulders. I'm dreading the day when he won't be able to walk up the stairs or take himself outside to, go to the bathroom. Because what's going to happen then? Well, I think it's going to be me gets the job of taking him to the vets, probably the big green needle. And what will happen? My family will be deeply upset and then we'll move on. Now, I've got a few more years than Musket. But the time will come when I can't walk up the stairs and when I'm not really functional, and then, well, I hope it's a hospice rather than the vets, I will disappear and my family will be upset and then I'll move on. And what's the difference? Under the sun? I'll tell you the difference. I know it's coming. I don't think he does. He doesn't seem worried about anything, really. Now, can you see why humanity, this is a very clever chapter, can you see why humanity lives with such angst and existential pain? We live with eternity in our hearts and we die like our pets. We live with eternity in our hearts, we know there's more, and yet we die like the animals. Is it any wonder we feel like life is too short? Is it any wonder we fear death? And is it any wonder at a funeral of someone we love we feel cheated? But under the sun, who knows how to make sense of that? See verse 22. So I saw that there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work, because this is their lot. But who can bring them to see what will happen after them? So you live under the sun. Well, we build, we demolish, we laugh and we weep, we're born and we die. There is no justice ultimately, and the best you can do is enjoy your work. Why? Because death flattens everything. Now, aren't you glad you came for breakfast this morning? Now, the good news is this. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not live just under the sun. God has spoken to us. This book of the Bible is doing us a great favour to push us the implications of trying to live that way. But the rest of the Bible is telling us God has spoken to us. And 1,000 years after, or almost 1,000 years after this was written, the Apostle Paul, the great Christian leader who took the Christian message out to the Gentile world, writes a letter about his message, writes a letter to the people who have become Christians in Corinth, a city in Greece. And look what he says. He says this: if I fought wild beasts in Ephesus with no more than human hopes, what have I gained? Essentially what he's saying is, all this pain and persecution and suffering I've had because of the Christian message, if all there is life under the sun, and that's what he means by human hopes, well, what's the point? He says, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. That's a quote from one of the prophets, the prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament. But hey, that's it. If there's nothing else, well, eat and drink, we're going to die tomorrow. Why is he saying that's not the case? The answer is this: because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He says, but Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. Now, the resurrection of Jesus, Paul is claiming, well, he met the risen Jesus right, on the road to Damascus, and the others had their lives transformed as well, that the resurrection of Jesus is like a peg driven into history, this event that happened that changes everything. And the first fruits idea, the promise of Jesus made is this, that as he has been raised, ready for eternity, for the new creation, etc., that those who trust him will also be raised to be like him one day. And that hope of the resurrection to come and the new creation, changes everything. I want to show you, now Pete Wrench has told me this is not going to work, so let's see. I want to show you a clip from Q&A, in 2013, they held Q&A as part of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And on the panel was Peter Hitchens, Peter Hitchens' brother of Christopher Hitchens, the new atheist man who unfortunately died a few years ago. Peter Hitchens is a journalist and writer, etc. And let me show you a clip from Q&A where one of the audience members asks, what do they think is the most dangerous idea that they know of? Let's see if this works.
Which so-called dangerous idea do you each think would have the greatest potential to change the world for the better if it were implemented?
The most dangerous idea in human history and philosophy remains the belief that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and rose from the dead. And that is the most dangerous idea you will ever encounter.
Just quickly, I think you can't really leave it there. Why dangerous?
I can't really leave it there because it alters the whole of human behavior and all our responsibilities. It turns the universe from a meaningless chaos into a designed place in which there is justice and there is hope. And therefore we all have a duty to discover the nature of that justice and work towards that hope. It alters us all. If we reject it, it alters us all as well. It is incredibly dangerous. It's why so many people turn against
it. Oh, it did work. Now, talk about the right thing said at the right time. Let me give you that again slowly. What he said is brilliant and the implications of it. Here we go. The most dangerous idea in human history and philosophy remains the belief... I'll drop it in. Belief that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and rose from the dead. And that is the most dangerous idea you will ever encounter. And he's asked by Tony Jones why. Here's what he said. Because it alters the whole of human behavior and all our responsibilities. It turns the universe from a meaningless chaos into a designed place in which there is justice and there is hope. And therefore we all have a duty to discover the nature of that justice and work toward that hope. It alters us all. If we reject it, it alters us all as well. It is incredibly dangerous. It's why so many people turn against it. Profound words. In Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, he talks about the fact that the early Christians really understood the resurrection and the implications of it. And what he says is those first Christians lived, faced persecution, disease, and death in a totally countercultural way. And ultimately, because they could live with hope and generosity and free from fear, they transformed the world. Understanding the resurrection of Jesus and the promise of the future changes everything. So let me pull two threads together. First one, what time is it for you? Have you got your life, your actions in line with the rhythms of there's the day, I'd put it to you, the rhythms of the day, there's the rhythms of the year, and there's the seasons of life. And wisdom is fitting in with what season it is. And if I could ask you, do you have the hope of the resurrection? Do you understand that? And if you're not sure why it is, how it is a peg anchored in history, let us know. I'm sure Pete would be happy to organise, or I'd be happy to organise, take you through the evidence. I'm done, Peter. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, as usual, some very interesting questions, which range from the... I wouldn't say trivial, the sublime to the ridiculous, or from the ridiculous to the sublime. Do you think the focus in our society on looking young and fit is reflective of this burden? What's the place of, quote, beach muscles? Ecclesiastes does not... here's where it's very important to understand. The word translated meaningless doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it won't last. In 2 weeks' time, we'll get to the end of chapter 11, where Ecclesiastes says, rejoice in your youth. Enjoy being young and strong and fit and make the most of it. And then at the end, he'll say, so then banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. Now, that's where the translation is difficult. He's not saying it's meaningless. He's saying it doesn't last. So enjoy being young and fit and strong. And like every time I see my son, I get a hug from him. All right. And he's 31. He's at the gym all the time. It's like getting a hug from a friendly gorilla. It's beautiful. But I want to say to him, mate, enjoy it, because time and gravity, you can't beat it. And what he's saying is when it's gone, it's gone. And we live in a society that if health and fitness and beauty is your God, you're going to die the death. Was it 1,000 natural shocks? There's nothing sadder than someone, when it's gone, then they can't let it go. I'll also listen to that one again for myself. Any suggestions for how to better recognise what season it is? There's a day-by-day thing that it's worth even just thinking through the rhythms of the day and what's the best way to organise your life and the discipline for that. I know for me, self-discipline isn't first thing in the morning. Self-discipline is at night when I actually need to go to bed so I can sleep, so I can get up and be vaguely alert. So there's a daily routine. But in terms of the seasons of life, I think even being aware of this different way to think is a start. It's very easy with technology to think what it's all about is to fit as much as possible into every day and as cram every day, etc., and be able to work all the time, etc. No. What's the season? What's the wise way to do things? And what season is it? Even thinking through that is the start. It's a little harder to answer it, I think, in the hypothetical. I guess the other thing, though, is to realise, too, as you get older, there are certain things that are gone, certain things that you could do or certain opportunities or whatever, and when they're gone, let them go. What does the Bible say about the need and the times to delegate? I'll have to take that one on notice, I think. The Bible doesn't claim, interesting, the Bible doesn't claim to give all knowledge or all knowledge that's necessary. The Bible says it contains the Bible says itself, it contains everything you need for life and how to live a life that pleases God, life and godliness. And so it'll tell you everything you need to know to live a life, to relate to God properly, to find forgiveness, to ultimately find salvation in the Bible's words. But in terms of how to run a business or how to delegate, you know, there's plenty of wisdom out there outside the Bible as well. What the Bible does say, actually, is God gifts people. And people have particular gifts and abilities. And the way for things to operate properly is to get those people who are gifted and the most gifted to be doing things. That's maybe another angle to think about. Is Christianity a cure for anxiety? Yes, but Christians are still a work in progress. That might be the way to put it. And does that mean if you become a Christian, you'll never feel anxious? No, it doesn't mean that. My dear sweet mum was a wonderful Christian lady, and yet she was constantly anxious about things. I know another young guy who's not a Christian. I don't think he's had an anxious day in his life. So there's just different personalities. But what I can say is this. Jesus is very gentle in the Sermon on the Mount as he speaks to his anxious people. And he says, why do you worry about things? God looks after the sparrows. God cares for the grass of the field. He'll clothe you like he clothes the lilies, etc., etc. And he says, so don't worry. You can't add an hour to your life by worrying. Don't worry. God will look after you. So he doesn't smack his followers in the ear and say, don't worry. He's gentle with them. In Romans chapter 8, the Apostle Paul says that if you belong to Jesus, everything that happens will ultimately work for your good to make you like him. I don't mean feel good about him. I mean make you become like him. Thank you. I missed the word. Make you become like him. Now, that doesn't mean that life will be easy because it's generally the harder things in life that mould us and change us. But here's what I want to say. The more that the follower of Jesus is able to internalize and understand and make those truths real in his or her life, I think the less that we will worry. Okay? So if you're an anxious person, don't feel guilty about it. Don't add guilt to anxiety. I think it's more you can understand the promises that Jesus makes and the New Testament makes, the more we're able to deal with anxiety. But it is interesting that anxiety is a plague in our modern world. 1 in 6 visits to a GP is anxiety related, and it's something like 1 in 6 Australians in any one year will have anxiety to the level that it affects their actual functioning in life. Life under the sun, I think, is anxiety producing. Any clues on when a Christian should, quote, give up, as per verse 6, apart from trying to imitate English accents. Okay, I did try it. I thought never giving up was universally seen as a key for success for everyone, including Christians. Yeah, I do believe it's that famous speech by Winston Churchill where he said, never give up, three or four times. Perseverance and to keep on going in things certainly is a would be seen as a virtue of the person who follows Jesus. You find it in the letter to the Colossians in chapter 1, verse 10, where Paul says, or between 10 and 12, where Paul says, the work of God's Spirit in these people would be to give them great patience and endurance. And patience and endurance keep coming up in the New Testament. It's easy to overlook the work of God in someone's life. If it's not big and flashy, etc., we may not notice it. But the Apostle Paul is saying the Spirit of God at work in someone's life will give them patience and endurance. And that's important. But I think too, wisdom would say, a friend of mine says, when the horse is dead, get off. And wisdom is recognizing in whatever it is you're doing, if the horse is dead, get off. One more. We got time, Pete? We've got, yeah, one more? Okay. And this is, I left this one to last deliberately. Why do you think youth suicide is now critical at this time? It's interesting how little we talk about suicide as a culture. I think we're afraid that talking about it will put it into the minds of people. In his book, Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari gives the figures from the World Health Organization in 2002. They added up all people on the planet, as far as they could work out, killed in war that year, about 170,000. Everyone killed in any kind of violent crime, etc., about 570,000, added them together and came up with, it was around 700 and something thousand people basically died at the hands of someone else. And then he had the figure for suicide worldwide, which was significantly higher, around 870,000. We are more likely to die as a human race, are more likely to die at our own hands than the hands of anyone else. And here's the great irony. In countries that are struggling with poverty and injustice, the suicide rate is around about 5 per 100,000. In Sweden, New Zealand, and a list of half a dozen other, what we might call developed countries, the suicide rate is 10 per 100,000 or more. It's the wealth, the privilege, it's the well-off, it's a, kill themselves at double the rate. In Australia, suicide is the biggest killer of people between the ages of 18 and 45. Every day in Australia, 6 men kill themselves. The suicide rate is about 3 to 1, men to women. I think women attempt suicide more often. Men get the job done. They do it in different ways. And you've got to ask yourself, why? And I think the book of Ecclesiastes speaks to it. We live in a culture, and now the developed world lives in a culture where we've walked away from God. We've got full credit cards and empty hearts. And there's nothing there. And is it any wonder people see that we live with eternity in our hearts and we die like our pets? And that, now, I'm not saying become... Christians can suffer from depression as well. I'm not drawing any lines for individual people. And I've known, you know, Christians can suffer from depression, etc. But as a society, I think we give young people nothing at the moment in terms of what to believe and what to look forward to. And is it any wonder they end up nihilistic or, you know, pornography or video games or whatever it is? Climate change. Yeah, that's the answer. So, yeah. I think Jesus is the answer. So, yeah. Pete?
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.